Hi, volleyball fans, and welcome back to Volley Talk, the podcast created for volleyball lovers who want to dig deep into what is going on in NCAA and international volleyball. I'm your host, Sarah Pavin. I'm an Olympian, beach volleyball world champion, former Nebraska Cornhusker, and longtime pro, both indoor and on the beach.
And I'm Adam Schultz, former indoor player, international volleyball coach, and the show's resident stat guy.
The first season of Love is in the books, everybody. And
done.
We are dedicating this episode not only to unpacking the final weekend that just happened, but also to analyzing all things Love after their inaugural season, what we thought went well, what we would change, just a full rundown. We do have a few updates from the rest of the volleyball world, but overall, this is going to be a Love season recap, so buckle up because we're about to get started. In NCAA women's volleyball,
still making headlines.
The Creighton head coach, Kirsten Bernthal Booth, stepped away from the program after leading it for 22 years. So her assistant, Brian Rosen, is going to replace her as the head coach. But she is actually going to be taking on an administrative role within Love in Omaha. I feel like that is a bold move when you're the head coach of a top 10 program. You built the program, and then you're going to leave to go be an admin in Love. That's, wow.
I wonder, 22 years as a head coach of a program is a lot of time, energy, effort, love that goes into doing that. You're on the roads. I'm wondering if this is a way to be in the sport and wind down a little bit, because that's a long time.
I mean, good for her. She seems excited about it. I was just shocked when I saw the news because I was like, dang, they had a really good season last year. They've been getting better and better. But best of luck to her and to Creighton as they move forward. The Italian League playoffs, as you know, still happening. So Conegliano beat Novara in four matches. Milano took down Scandicci 3-0. So those two teams are meeting up in the finals. That starts this week. And then on the men's side, Trentino is up 2-0 on Piacenza. And Perugia is up 2-0 on Civitanova. So match three, which could potentially be the last set of matches for the men's semis, is also happening on Wednesday. So we are winding down seasons left and right here. Speaking of that, NCAA men, wasn't as wacky a week as last week, holy. But Lewis beat Loyola Chicago 3-0. So they actually took them down in both of their matches this season in MIVA. UCLA beat BYU in both of their matches. They won in four and in five. USC got taken down twice by Stanford in four and five.
That is the upset of the week. And, you know, just after we thought Stanford had hit the pause button on their season because they weren't playing well, I think we should start collecting royalties from NCAA men's programs. We'll talk about them playing poorly, and then they'll come back the next week, and they will beat great opponents. So I think we should start a fund for that.
For sure. It's actually uncanny at this point how often it's been happening. And then they go back down to earth next week.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, was not expecting that. Long Beach State and Hawaii split. Long Beach took the first in four, and then Hawaii won the second in five. We were ultra-focused on Love this weekend, so we didn't watch. We will probably touch on some of these matches in our next episode because
I'm watching those two.
There was just too much to cover with Love finishing up this week. We wanted to put a nice bow on it, but that is a big match, set of big matches. Unfortunately, I don't think it even matters because now Hawaii and Long Beach State have both lost two matches in the Big West. So, you know, Hawaii had their chance last week against CSUN. If they had managed to leave that series with two wins, they very likely would have gone into the Big West tournament as number one. But now, I think it's going to go to Long Beach State probably.
Interesting that they split, figuring that there's at least a decent likelihood they meet in the final. So both teams are leaving feeling optimistic with their chances, I think, after that.
It'll be a very interesting playoff time. Speaking of that, the MEVA playoff bracket is set. So Loyola Chicago actually took the one seed, followed by McKendree, Ohio State, Lewis, and Ball State. So Ball State and Lewis are facing off in the quarters, which leaves, if Lewis wins, they're going to be facing Loyola Chicago in the semi, and Lewis has beaten Loyola Chicago in both of their MEVA matches this year.
That one's going to be interesting to follow to see if Loyola Chicago, you know, whether they knew this match didn't mean much to them in the standings, whether they're going to be ready to go. Can you flick the switch? That is also one that I'm curious to watch come playoff time.
And McKendree, that's their best finish in MEVA ever. Congrats to McKendree for a great regular season. Are they going to be able to keep the pedal to the metal in playoff time? They've got a tough opponent in the potential semi if they advance in Ohio State. So things are going to get spicy once the semifinals roll around in MEVA. And the only other conference whose sort of conference tournament bracket has come out is Conference Carolinas. So Mount Olive and Belmont Abbey have the top two seeds there. So it is likely that one of those two teams are going to be in the tournament as well.
Looking to the PVF this week, Atlanta took care of business again, beating San Diego and Orlando. Vegas, back to not being able to buy a win. They lost both their games, one to Omaha and one to Columbus. Grand Rapids surprised Indy in five. And as overall standings go, Vegas has now dropped to seventh. And they're only one game up on Columbus. Now, I will say that I picked Columbus to not finish last. But I didn't think at the time that it would be Vegas that fell below them. That is a fall from grace, quite frankly. They
like,
have been awful.
Literally from top to bottom.
Yeah, that's hard to do.
And that game against Columbus was clearly important.
Definitely.
Well, now we see how important it was, how close they are in the standings. They're only a game up on Columbus, and Columbus beat them.
Well, now I wonder if they're trying to tank on purpose for the draft. But, I mean, I have to think as a head coach, you're also fighting for your job at that point, because it's a mess. So we'll see how they play out at the end of the season and what happens there. But if we look at the standings for the PVF, again, the top four teams go on to the playoffs. This is looking kind of set at this point. I think we would have to see, you know, a spectacular run or a pretty big fall off. But the rankings are Omaha 1, then Atlanta, Orlando, and Indy. And
so Orlando jumped up a spot. They were hanging out in fourth. Indy probably wants that game back from Grand Rapids.
Yeah, definitely. And there's still room for a little bit of jockeying. But in terms of going to the playoffs, I think that those teams are kind of shoo-ins unless there's a catastrophe.
That might be our quickest weekly highlights in recent memory, ladies and gentlemen. We flew through that because we've got a lot to take care of on the love front. Honestly, it was a slow week overall in volleyball. Love definitely took the focus. Things are, like we said, kind of winding down here. NCAA men are going to have their conference tournament soon. PVF only has a few matches left, and then we're going to get into international season. So just kept it snip-snap, you know, nice and quick this week. But still, some interesting stuff nonetheless. All right, everybody, let's dive in to the love finals. As you know, the season-ending tournament playoff battle happened this week in Louisville in conjunction with the JVA World Challenge youth event that was happening there. So we had two quarters followed by two semis with the grand finale on Sunday. In the strangest turn of events that ever could have happened. I don't even know where to begin with this whole weekend.
Well, the word of the weekend was upset.
Literally from start to finish. Okay, so quarterfinal one, Salt Lake versus Austin, reverse sweep. Austin wins. Very close match, though. All sets were a difference of 2 points.
Entertaining match.
Salt Lake had no business losing that.
Correct.
They were up 14-10 in the fifth.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Are you kidding me?
They could not close it out.
How do you lose that? I definitely have some strong thoughts about that last run of points, but...
Do tell.
Okay. If you insist. Ronnie Jones-Perry imploded. I understand that Skylar Fields couldn't score. I understand that they had trouble putting the ball on the ground. There were a couple very diggable balls, and there were a couple lollipop serves, all to Ronnie Jones-Perry, who didn't dig anything and got aced, passed backwards. It's in the details here, people. I understand, put a ball on the ground, I get it. Somebody had to finish, but there were a couple very straightforward plays, and she was at the center of all of them. So my question for you is, what, aside from the meltdown at the end, what do you attribute the turnaround in that match to? Because Salt Lake was up 2-0, and then abracadabra.
I thought that Austin was able to run their middles, and their middles dominated that match, in my opinion. They both played phenomenal. In fact, Molly McCage had maybe the best weekend of her life. She was unbelievable. Yeah. So, I mean, Maddie Skinner was also good. Give her props where props is due. She held her own, scored a lot of points. Wasn't the most efficient attacker, but she scored big points for them. But for me, it was Molly and Chiaka. Molly hit 476 on 21 attempts and had 6 blocks. She scored 20 points alone, which was the second highest on the team.
As a middle, that's wild.
But follow that up by Chiaka, who also had 15 points and 7 blocks. She didn't attack as efficient as Molly did, but those two were able to kind of hold the middle of the court and be difference makers. And to me, that was the difference. And we can talk about Salt Lake serving, maybe letting off a little pressure, or Austin passing a little better or finding their rhythm. But for me, overall, the middles were golden in this match. The other thing I will say about this match is Salt Lake outdug Austin 82-68. They had multiple opportunities, and their pin hitters could not find ways to score in key moments. That, I think that was honestly the biggest difference.
That was the start of the absolute mind meld that happened in Louisville this weekend. Just, I still am having trouble processing everything that I witnessed, but in the second quarterfinal, Omaha beat Madison in 4. And last week, if you remember, Adam was 100% sure.
I sure was.
That Madison was going to dominate that match. I think we all were pretty confident. I thought Salt Lake was going to win the other one.
I mean, Omaha came together. Everything came together for them. It was actually crazy to watch. And, you know, they had 3 matches, and we'll talk about it. But the combination of Sammy Francis and Lauren Stivrens being in that match were huge difference makers overall in the whole weekend. Not necessarily, not quite as much in this match specifically. In this match, Maddie Kubik Banks played incredibly well.
Very good.
She was unbelievable. And I mean, I don't think we should be surprised, but Jordan Larson had a very good weekend for her team.
She just had a different attitude about her, I thought, compared to what we've seen for the rest of the season. Like, you could tell she really wanted to win this weekend. And it was a pleasure getting to watch her play like that before. And I don't, what I'm assuming will be a retirement, I don't know. But it was really great to see that kind of fire and execution again.
She decided that this mattered to her.
Yes.
And she was willing to put the effort in, and it showed in all of the matches. She led that team and that intensity and those intangibles along with playing well.
And Justine Wongerontes was unreal.
So good.
Her defense is so good. And we've gotten so many questions. Why isn't Lexi playing? Why isn't Lexi playing? Because Justine is just better.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. She is so good defensively. She's an outstanding setter. Like, her passing is solid. There is a reason why she is the starting libero and Lexi isn't. And I know Lexi's got a lot of fans, but, like, she put on a show. And some of the balls that she picked up, I was like, wow.
Yeah. Totally agree. And then on the flip side, Sarah Franklin struggled. That was, for me, I thought she was going to be a difference maker in these playoffs. I thought she was going to elevate the same way we've seen her elevate in the past. I thought that she was finding her rhythm, both passing and attacking wise, coming into this. I know it was a bit of a roller coaster season for her. I expected her to have a good match, and you know, she really didn't. They kind of stopped setting her. She only got 23 sets, and she hit 087. She only scored 8 points. She was a bit of a passing liability, you know, on top of everything else. They needed her to be able to score points, and she just didn't rise to the occasion on this particular day.
And they brought Chausse in for her eventually,
who played well. I mean, she only got 17 sets, but she hit 353. Like, she did what she could do in the given situation, but you needed Sarah Franklin to be the Sarah Franklin we've seen, you know, throughout her career.
I think we've talked about this before with Madison. They set Annie Drew Schumacher so much.
52 times.
It's too much.
Well, the next closest person got 30. You just know where the ball's going.
Well, and the thing is like, definitely she carried Madison through that win streak that they went through at the end of the season. But when it mattered, she didn't show up. They fed her so many balls at the end of set 3 and 4 in that quarterfinal, and she couldn't score. And again, she did a great job helping Madison and leading Madison to the position they ended up in the regular season. But when the regular season doesn't really matter, like, that match mattered, and they just kept feeding her the ball, and she was just not putting it away.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the stats were pretty similar in terms of the serving and the blocking, but the big differentiator was defensively, no surprise, with Jordan and
Justine
in the back row. They had 71 digs to Madison's 56, and they've dug well all season, but their hitters scored in these matches. All of their hitters hit over 200. Most of them hit over 300. As a team, they were incredibly efficient, and they hit 353 in this match as a team. If you're going to dig that many balls inside out like that, you're going to win matches. And they just executed.
Okay, let's move on to the semifinals. This is the point in the tournament where I started being like, there is a conspiracy going on. There was no reason. Atlanta and Houston were by far the best two teams in this league. The fact that both of them lost to the bottom two seeded teams, I was like, they the league wanted this to happen. They wanted the markets of Austin and Omaha to make it to that final and then to build off of their narrative about how much parity there is in the league and how many five setters the league has had this season. Like, come on, you cannot tell me that two reverse sweeps in the semifinals to get those two markets into the final. I'm not saying this actually happened, but I was so convinced that there was some sort of love conspiracy going on. I could not believe what I was watching.
Again, for Austin, to me, the story for them was they ran their middles consistently. I'm looking at my notes from this match, and set one, Austin running the middle. Set two, Austin still running the middle. Like, they were able, and that matters in those five-set matches. When your middles are a threat all throughout the match, that opens up your outside hitters when it counts. And again, let's look at this. Now, Maddie Skinner, again, she was phenomenal. She had 29 points. She hit 364 on 55 attacks. She was very good. But your next two best players, Chiaka and Molly, hitting 238 for Chiaka, which was better than the match before, but she had four blocks, and Molly hitting 625. They both had 13 points. That makes a difference. They were very good. And on the flip side for Atlanta, I thought Coutinho played well, 20 points, hit 364. Mackenzie Adams played very well in the first two sets. She was 229 on the match, but much higher in those first two sets. And I thought Tia Jimmerson played pretty well. But Austin showed that if they were passing well and in system, they just had too many weapons. And I don't think it had all come together for Austin at any point in this season, but it all just clicked this weekend.
Their passing has not been a strength all season. Their setting was a liability all season.
Carly Lloyd just hanging out and waiting to rock it in the final.
They couldn't figure out which setter was going to be consistent at any given time. So that was rough. The passing, the libero switch they made when they had the coaching change, I think that was a big plus because Inoue, I think she is very good. And as we were saying the entire season, get Chiaka involved as much as possible. And to their credit, in the matches that they won, which were all of them, they got good passing teams in trouble. They upped their service pressure, their passing improved, and they ran their middles so much more consistently than they have been. And it came together right when it had to, like you said.
I have a question for you. Do you prefer Madison Skinner out of the front row or the back row?
She's 100% a better hitter from the back row.
My second question is, she's always going to be on the radar because of her physicality, but do you think that this performance this weekend raises her stock for Team USA as a right side?
I mean, we knew she would be in the conversation. The question, I still don't think she hits angles. I still think she hits very straight the majority of the time. I think she definitely needs to become a little more creative. I think from the back row, she's outstanding. As I said, I prefer her as a back row hitter than front row hitter. Her blocking on the right side has improved. Do I think that she can compete right now with the likes of the Isabel Hawks, the Boscovich, the Vargas, the Eganu? No. I think they're
a little more seasoned.
Their angles are better. They're hitting the ball harder. Like, they have much more experience. I think she'll be in the conversation, and I think it just depends who else they bring and if how bad Jordan Thompson wants to hold on to her spot. Okay, part two of my semifinal conspiracy theory was Houston versus Omaha.
This, to me, was the biggest upset of the weekend. And you look at Austin in the other semifinal, you always knew they had a ton of really good athletes, and they just couldn't seem to figure out how to put all the pieces together. But This one, I just never saw this coming.
Well, I think a huge shock to me, Maddie Kubik Banks got absolutely demolished in the face in the quarter.
That's one of my top five like packs in the face I've ever seen.
Oh man, and she was in six back too. That's the craziest part. Anyway, got concussed, was in concussion protocol. I thought the loss of her was going to be the beginning of the end for Omaha. I didn't think that it was a good matchup for them to begin with. And then seeing how Maddie has kind of really come into her own in the last chunk of the season, and losing her after a great performance the night before, I was like, okay, they're in trouble.
Yeah, I thought the same thing, because I didn't think Winters would be able to hang. And like you said, I don't think Winters was planning on playing. Kubik was playing well. Like, it's a blow to kind of the team's success at that point after a big win in the quarterfinals. To me, the story of this match was the three middles. And I know that Lauren Stivrens is on the right side, but she's still a middle in my books. And the head of that, Sammy Francis, was unconscious in this match. She played so well. And I know she only hit 222, but she got set 27 times in some tough situations. She scored the second most points on the team at 16 and had six blocks. She was a force out there. And coming in, having not practiced with the team on an emergency call-up or whatever the protocol was from there, she was outstanding.
I like her. She has got a little bit of swagger. She's not in your face about it, but oh man, you can tell. The way she looks through the net sometimes, I'm like, okay.
She's a girl after your own heart.
Yeah. And she just hits. She's a similar size to a lot of middles. She's 6'6", so she is big. But she's not hitting sharp angles. She's hitting high and deep to the corners, which is so different than what we typically see from middles. And it's very effective. I really like the way she hits the ball.
Yeah, and so between Sammy Francis, 16 points, Emily Thader, 14 points, Lauren Stivrens, 12 points coming in on the double sub, that's where most of their points came from, because the outside hitting core for Omaha struggled in this match. You had Drevniak hit 179, Jordan Larson hit 116, and Jayla Winters hit 063. Like, those three players were, to me, the only reason they won that match. And it was really cool to see, because it's middles always affect whether you win or lose, but very...
they get no love.
Yeah, very rarely do you see the core of them taking over a match and the reason you won. And I don't mean to cut Wong Arontis out, because she was very good in this match.
Again, yeah, she was. Houston, however, Raphael Foley finally getting the respect she deserves. She played very well.
She had eight blocks in that match.
Yeah. Rischel is always steady. She's there predominantly, as we have said, for her ball control, her defense.
Hit 204. You can't ask anything else
like
from her.
That's like her job. Mrzek, as much as Maddie Skinner has elevated her performance in the last little while, I would say Franklin and Mrzek went in the opposite direction. She did nothing.
She hit 050 on 40 sets.
Couldn't pass.
No.
Missed serves. Couldn't score. Like, I was disappointed.
I would agree, because I think these are the moments where, you know, as Mrzek, Franklin, you want to be able to elevate, and those teams are reliant on you, and it just didn't happen for them. And I was having a hard time reading Mrzek's body language. She almost seemed
resigned to their
aloof.
Fate.
Yeah. Like it wasn't, you didn't see that fight that you saw when she was in college. It was smile, hug your teammate, you know, come back in. And that's fine if that's who you are.
Like, the fire I saw from Jordan Larson is what I expected from Mrzek. Like, you're in the beginning of your career. You had better be showing up, because like, people are watching your career. Like, You're just at the beginning. You're still trying to make an impression. Meanwhile, Jordan Larson's at the end, and she is coming with more fight and more fire and more, like, gumption than you. Like, that's a problem.
And Jordan calling the ball. Like, she didn't have a great night, but when the sets were on the line, she was calling for the ball. She was making digs. She was taking swings. Yes.
She made plays down the stretch because there were a couple really tight sets that she found ways to score.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you think about Houston's double sub? Because it was being criticized left, right, and center all match about what a terrible choice it was. What do you think about the frequency at which they were doing the double sub and taking Hancock and Thompson out?
I didn't really have a problem with it. I thought the other players came in, did what they needed to do. I mean, they've been successful for a long time. They've used that double sub throughout the season, as far as I'm aware. You know, it's not like Jordan Thompson was unconscious in that match. Like, she played well, but she wasn't scoring on everything she touched. And, I mean, Micah Hancock is obviously very good. And also, credit to her, she served unbelievably well in this match. Oh, my
gosh. I think she missed, like, one the whole match.
Yeah, and she was the reason, quite frankly, they won the first two sets. She had serving runs. One of them was in the double digits, I believe.
Crazy.
And I think it was the first set. She was so good in that regard. But you know what? I didn't have a problem with it.
It is something that they've relied on all season. They were number two in the league. They've had a lot of success. Like, for all intents and purposes, it should still be going. And I understand that Grace Froehling hasn't played for a little while, but, like, it hasn't been criticized up until this point. And just because they were getting into some run issues, all of a sudden it was because of the double sub. And I was like, wait, what?
Well, but they don't make many other subs, so you have them sitting there, and if you need to use it, you use it, and if it doesn't work, you can take it out. Like, I didn't think it was a coaching error in any way, shape, or form.
And like you said, I feel like it was kind of a similar situation to the Annie Drew Schumacher, where Jordan Thompson was quite dominant in the second part of the season, and I don't think, like, she was okay, but I don't think she was playing at the level that we are used to seeing her play at in that match.
Well, again, she played well in the first two sets. And
the sets they won.
Yeah. And then she had a little trouble scoring. And again, she had trouble scoring after 20. And we have mentioned that before, because you know where the ball is going. Like, at that point, Mrzek's not playing particularly well. Point is on the line. Everybody knows it's going to Jordan Thompson. They're putting up a good block. They're playing defense around them. You have Jordan Larson and Wong Arontis digging you. You have a decent-sized block up there when you're doing the Stiverins substitution and Sammy Francis is up there. Like, it was, they managed to apply a lot of pressure to Thompson at the end of those sets, and she didn't score, and Jordan did.
Friday night, I just sat after the games and I was like, I don't know what I just saw. Like, what is happening?
Sammy Francis coming to the team and Lauren Stiverins coming back from injury injected new life to them. And maybe there's something to be said for not having video on them, for not seeing them before, because you saw all of these other players, you know, seven times throughout the season. But those two found a way to make a difference, and it was fun to watch.
And now the final. Unfortunately, the most straightforward of all the matches. You would hope that the final would be the most exciting, but this one was pretty cut and dry. A dominant performance by Austin.
They just weren't going to lose.
No, they... Omaha is known for their passing and defense. Austin found a way to break down their serve receive. They were also in system, which has been their weakness. So they had all options available all the time, and they blocked like crazy.
16 blocks to 3 on the match. That's insane.
Insane. Omaha's passing struggled, so their offense was quite slow. And with a blocking core like Austin has, you can't run it that slow, because they were just camped out. They knew where the ball was going at all time. And honestly, they didn't even have to leave. They didn't even have to read or do any planning. It was just like, wait for the set, close the block. It was like very volleyball 101.
I mean, Austin's middles were good again, but the story of this match was Logan Eggleston and Maddie Skinner. I have to read you their stat line because it's off the hook. Logan hit 469 on 32 attempts, and she had 5 blocks for 22 points on the match in 3 sets. She was amazing. And Skinner followed up right behind, 21 points, hit 308 on 39 sets, hit some ridiculous shots coming out of the back row. It was amazing to watch. She also had 4 blocks and 5 digs. Like, those two players showed up to play in the final and were untouchable.
Well, and we have to give credit to Ogbagu and McCage too, because they were so good in the first two matches that Omaha knew, if Austin is in system, we need to stick with their middles. And I'm not saying that Eggleston and Skinner had like no block up. They definitely did. But the way, the power of the middle when it is working, and it was working really well in the two matches leading up to that, it makes your outsides' lives so much easier. Like, there were definitely some seams available. There were some angles available that probably wouldn't normally be if, A, they weren't passing so well, and B, the middles hadn't just dominated in the matches prior. I kept saying all match, Omaha needs to just, like, unload on their serves because they have no chance. They're just, Austin was in system all the time.
I mean, Omaha didn't take enough chances from the service line. They had 2 aces and 2 errors. They needed to go back and bomb serves at the passers. And there's one other interesting thing. You talk about the middles not being able to close and leaving some seams. What that does is it allows the hitters to stay away from Justine. It gives you options to not have to go to where they're setting up their defense. And that also renders her more ineffective than she was against the other matches. And I thought that was a huge... They managed to take her out of the game a little bit.
Yeah. Well, we saw Dikema did not play good defense. The outsides for Austin had their way hitting the ball at her. She was not picking anything up. And they were hammering balls in the seam. Like, there were balls that landed in the middle of the court between the block. Like, you're not going to stop that. And so it was disappointing not to see Omaha make the serving adjustment and just go for it, because I think that is a huge reason for Austin's success over the weekend, is their service pressure definitely increased. And they missed a bunch out the baseline in all matches we watched, but they just kept going, and it allowed their block to come into it, which is their strength.
Well, they made life for Jayla Winters miserable.
Winters was absolutely atrocious. I'm sorry.
She hit negative 03 on 31 sets.
She had trouble passing.
Yeah.
She offensively was a liability. Yeah. Omaha in general struggled passing, but like, they targeted her the most.
Yeah. And I mean, Sammy Francis and Emily Thader still had pretty good matches. Like, they were able to score when they got chances. Stiverins and Blossom struggled to connect in this match, which we hadn't seen up until that point. So Stiverins was kind of held off the score sheet. She hit 0 on 14 sets, and she was able to generate some offense in the other matches. I thought Jordan was steady. She hit almost 300 on 24 sets. You know, she was trying to will that team, you know, to keep going, but Winters was just not able to hang.
And Jordan's not attacking out of the back row.
Yeah.
So it just kind of exposes her even more. I mean, Austin deserved to win that match.
They had the best weekend.
The weekend that they put together was what they needed. They were outstanding. They got their, as we were saying, they got their serving dialed in. The most importantly, got their passing sorted out. They were able to every one of their hitters was able to have an impact and put up some great numbers. They are the team that looked the best this weekend.
They put it all together in the three matches that it mattered for.
And not surprisingly, given her weekend, Maddie Skinner was MVP of the finals.
As she should be.
She elevated. It was really cool to see. And you could see she was gaining confidence like every swing she took.
Yeah.
So congrats to Austin, the inaugural Love champions, getting their names all over that Tiffany trophy we heard so much about.
It was a fun weekend of volleyball for the most part. It looked like good competition. Teams were out there playing hard, back and forth. It was enjoyable.
All right. With the season officially wrapped, we wanted to go over a bit of an analysis on the league, talk about some things they did well, things that maybe we would hope to see look different moving forward, things like that. So we're breaking it down into different categories, and we're just going to kind of discuss our thoughts as we go. So to start, Love's mission. What are your thoughts on their mission and what they're about?
So I love the idea of it being from the grassroots to the pro level. I think that that is a great vision and mission for how sport should be done. I like that they spent time, you know, as far as we're aware, giving back to clubs in the cities that they were, being accessible to the young female athletes. I think for those athletes having a role model, being in the gym, seeing that, I think it's fantastic. So what they're trying to do and how they're taking a holistic approach to it, also in terms of the maternity leave and how they structure, you know, those things around the athletes, I 100% on board.
I agree. I am all about what they're trying to do. I think especially as a young female athlete, having examples that you can look up to in your own country, potentially in your own city, your own training gym, that will keep girls in sport longer. And I think it's necessary because girls drop out of sport so quickly once they reach about 13 years old. So I think their mission for female athletics, female volleyball, is amazing, creating that pathway from youth to college to the pro level. I am all about what they are trying to do from a mission perspective, for sure.
What are your thoughts on the volleyball that you saw this season?
The level of volleyball is good. I think it's the best level that we see, you know, in North America right now. I think as far as like the enthusiasm, the passion, the drive that I saw in the finals, that is kind of what I would expect from professional athletes from start to finish. And I didn't really see that push and that drive and that outward desire to win so much as I did in the last weekend.
I think there were spurts throughout the season. A match would get heated in a fifth set, or there would be, you know, a close set. And after 15 back and forth, you would see glimpses of it. But I agree, for the most part, I think that weekend was much more intense and less friendly than the season.
Yeah, and like for the whole season, you could tell that the majority of athletes, particularly the Americans, were happy to be there. They were happy to be playing at home, not having to live overseas for, you know, whatever number of years they've been playing. It almost seemed like we've said this before, some of the matches just seemed like scrimmages where they're there, they're having a good time. Oh, national team teammates, we're all good, this is fun. I don't know, I like that when something is on the line, you see people get like maybe a little more aggressive, some stares through the net. It's exciting as a fan, and as a viewer to see that enthusiasm, to see the passion, to see how fired up they get when they score that tight point. And I wish that that had been there the whole season.
I mean, I think case in point was Jordan Larson. Exactly, you saw a different Jordan Larson in those three matches than you did all season, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And that I'm singling her out because her team kind of went from the bottom to the finals, and her specific performance was very marked, but it happened with a bunch of other athletes as well.
I would say, looking at the league as a whole, I think the setting was pretty strong. I would say the libero position was reasonably strong. I think they're lacking the most on the outside. Middles, I feel like it was 50-50. You had some middles that I was like, okay, this is really good. And then some where the level kind of dropped. But I think the biggest gap skill-wise in Love right now is on the outside. Because the libero and setting positions, I don't know if you agree with this or not, I thought they're solid.
Yeah, I agree. The offenses were good. The decision-making was good. The liberos, you know, passed well and for the most part found a way to make a difference on defense. Yeah, you don't see any of those big outside players that you are seeing in some of the other leagues. So yeah, I think that's a fair assessment.
Where would you rank this league from a volleyball level perspective compared to other leagues that we have watched or been exposed to?
I think it slots kind of in that second tier. You know, if you look at a Germany or a France or a Poland, you know, again, there's only six teams in Love, and they managed to divide the teams up so that there's a relative amount of parity. So I think that, you know, they would probably beat the lower ranked teams in those divisions and would, you know, struggle maybe with the top two teams from the other leagues and have really good games with the middle top. Like, I think in and around there.
Yeah, I think they would probably be competitive for sure in a Germany or France situation. And I know so many of you who listen to the podcast think that the German and French leagues are just terrible. But I would encourage you to think about how many teams are in those leagues. You know, like, Love has just six teams and they deliberately set out to try to make them as even as possible. You don't get that in other leagues where presidents and management are buying players from around the world. Yeah. When you're looking at a roster of teams with like 12 or more, in a league, like, sure, the bottom teams might not be great, but there's like a promotion and demotion thing happening. Like, the top teams are doing decently and advancing decently well in Champions League. So we need to think about that.
I mean, Justine Wong-Arontas, I think you told me, and if I'm not mistaken, played in the German leagues leading up to the
Olympics. She has made her career in Germany up until this point.
So if she's able to prepare for the Olympics to play on the highest level, like, there is good volleyball happening there.
Yeah, I would agree. I would kind of slot it in as a second tier league right now. And the thing is like, you're seeing so many experienced players in this league. Like, the majority of the athletes have been around.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like a lot of the top leagues where you've got like 20-year-old prodigies and the 24-year-old, like, current national team stars. Like, no, the majority of the athletes here are seasoned veterans. They're on their way out. They've played at a high level for a very long time. It's just a very different structure. So I think that lent itself to a good level of volleyball because of the experience, but it wasn't quite there compared to some other ones, obviously.
Well, and in this league, you have experience where it matters, right? A good libero and a good setter can... You have somebody who can quarterback the defense and make sure things are coming up, make sure you can consolidate the passing, and then you have a setter who understands the flow of the game, can maybe fix some things, run an offense, find players. Like, having experience in those two positions specifically allow the rest of the athletes to kind of fill in and maybe make up for, again, the Love Six, who don't have any professional experience. So I don't think the way they did it was smart, right? You brought in experience in key positions to kind of help everyone else around you.
What are your thoughts on the league branding? This kind of ties into a question that we received. This person asked, can you tell me your thoughts on the Love marketing, the scribbles that represent the team with the small VB letters is like really hard to understand. Like, how is this promoting the league? That's what this person asked.
I personally am not a fan of the branding. For me, because we don't have a team in our city, I want to pick a team to follow and to like. And I found that very hard to do with Love. There's just no differentiation. And I understand that that is the way the league is set up. You are a Love volleyball fan, but I think that there's something special about having a team. Mm-hmm. And following that team and being invested. I found it hard to go, oh, I really want to watch this team. It was more, oh, I think that that could be a good match. I think that these two players against each other will be interesting to watch. And even when you watch them on the court, it all kind of looks the same to you other than two different colors.
Like, and the jerseys are the same, the navy.
I like the feeling of home and away. I like knowing you're in somebody's gym, your home gym. Again, for me, I wish I could have identified and picked a team that I liked and just have them stand out. But I think that that was very intentional by the Love Squad. So I would say mission accomplished for what they wanted, but if I found it hard to resonate with personally.
Yeah, and I personally was not a fan of their team marketing either. You could kind of pick out the city names in those designs, but were they clear and distinct? Absolutely not. And your only differentiator is that little scribble and a color. Like, I wasn't a fan of that at all. So I doubt they'll change it. They'll probably keep it as it's going and keep everything under the Love umbrella, but their branding, not the best, in my opinion.
Let's talk about the format of the season. What were your thoughts?
I have a few thoughts. First of all, I think it got stale for me, like, really fast. The way that they had just a head-to-head match and then everybody else goes to one location, it gets kind of boring when you're seeing the same matchup over and over and over again. Like, even with six teams, I would have loved to see just a traditional, everybody kind of has a matchup for the weekend. You play at one team's home gym, you go through those, you go home, away, however many times you feel is necessary. But it just, I stopped looking forward to watching because it just felt stale.
For me, I had two thoughts. One is, I wish the playoffs would have been best of three series. I wish we could have seen some rivalries. Don't get me wrong, the weekend was intense. There was some good volleyball. There were some unexpected results. But a championship should be hard to win. Who cares if you win two matches? You know, do you know what I mean? You had that middle of the season tournament, which I thought was fine, breaks it up a little bit. You have an opportunity to do that. But for me, I want to see you work for a championship. If you're Omaha and you finish last in the league, you should have to grind an extra series. You should have to come back. I didn't feel like there was any value in the regular season. And you saw that in the performance of the athletes and in how they cared. I think they have to find a way to make more of the matches meaningful. And my other piece was, when you run the weekends back to back like this and you have a team that plays, you know, Saturday, Sunday, you do a disservice to the preparation and to playing your starting athletes. You know, you don't generally play back-to-back. There's not a chance to recover. There's not a chance to really prepare to play the other teams. you don't necessarily see as much strategy, in my opinion, as when you watched, you know, a Champions League where they play every 3 days or twice a week. And you can tell that there's preparation and thought that goes into that. A schedule like this is kind of made for the fans or to be in one location, again, which is fine, but it detracts from the overall performance, in my opinion.
Well, and to build on that, they kept talking about how the top two seeds had a benefit of not having to play the quarterfinal. I would argue that not playing that quarterfinal is actually a detriment to those teams, because the other teams that they're playing against had a chance to compete in that environment, in that arena. They got to get their rhythm down. And so I think that missing out on that first match, that first day, hurt, and obviously they lost, hurt the number one and two teams, because they didn't have the same opportunity to get into that rhythm. So
I agree.
I just hate how the regular season meant nothing. Like, you can, and as you were saying, you could kind of tell in the players' attitudes all season and how they changed in the last weekend, kind of, not across the board, but generally speaking. It doesn't matter. You can be terrible all season, and like we saw, the bottom two teams were in the final. Like, that shouldn't happen. And I think, again, anybody can win a one-off match. That is the beauty of sport. One-off matches are up for anybody to take. I think in a setting like this, it needs to be a best of three or a best of five series, because then you will truly see which team is better. Like Adam said, which team is able to make the adjustments, which teams can sustain performance and be consistent, because for me, that's what it means to be a professional. Anybody can have an upset on any given day. Yeah, it was the combination of it being stale in the regular season, to the regular season means nothing, to what we saw happen with the bottom two teams, who quite frankly did not deserve to be in the final after the way they performed all season, being rewarded like that. It just, I didn't like it. I mean, obviously the decisions that Love made were to get these women in front of as many youth athletes as possible. So I'm just wondering, like, do you think there's a way to take their mission of being visible to young volleyball players, combining that with what we just talked about what would be an ideal structure?
Yeah, and again, let me be clear. This is year one of a long plan that they've put together. Not everything is going to go well, you know? And to me, you had your first season. I think overall it was a success. How do you go back and look at your season and decide how it lines up and make changes to make it even better next year? That to me will be the mark of whether it was truly successful or not, is what lessons they learned and when. But I do think that you can do that. Even if you have a one-off match or a schedule that happens in one location, you could play those four teams that go to that location, just play one match that weekend. So they all go there. You have 2 days to maybe interact with athletes. Just take one match away and play, you know, four in one location if being in that city and doing that activation is important.
No, well, like they played the finals in conjunction with a huge youth tournament. So if they want to continue to do that, they're not going to be able to have a multi-match series.
So then do the quarterfinals best two of three, do the semifinals best two of three, and make the finals a one-off match so that you can hit your date. But it to get to the final should cost you something. You should have to earn that, in my opinion.
Okay, the last kind of piece that we wanted to touch on in our Love analysis was the television / presentation of the league. How did you feel about that?
This was the most disappointing thing for me. I didn't realize how much the presentation of a sporting event could affect your experience. And I've almost come to realize it's like a good libero. You just don't notice them.
Mm.
And quite frankly, I watched several love matches on mute this season and enjoyed the volleyball much better than I did when I listened to the commentary. And, you know, we've talked about this. I think people know how I feel. But there were two things that really bothered me watching the final specifically. One is the announcers went out of their way to put down other leagues around the world. And for me, when your mission is to elevate volleyball and support athletes, you don't have to go out of your way to bash the German and the French leagues from what players have apparently said. You don't have to put up graphics talking about how you're better than the Turkish and the Italian league. They actively went out of their way to kind of make those comparisons, and that, for me, didn't sit well. I didn't necessarily agree with all of the Olympian talk that happened throughout the season. I get it. You want to highlight the players. I think you can build up your players in a way that doesn't just talk about that. And my last piece was they very rarely spent time talking about the actual volleyball during the matches. Something great would happen, and all that would be said was, hey, that was amazing. She's a blah, 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 blah. Instead of talking about why it was a good play, what happened. It always seemed to come back to things that were irrelevant to the match about how great of a job Love as a whole did. And for me, that detracted from the actual watching experience of the volleyball itself.
Yeah, I got really frustrated watching the games. Having them on mute was enjoyable. I understand, you know, kind of educating your viewers, because the American audience hasn't really been exposed to a professional volleyball league like this before. So I understand in the first few weeks, kind of really hitting home on Love's mission, what kind of athletes are in the league, their history, where they came from, just as an education piece. But it doesn't need to continue all season. And the same messaging of so-and-so is the best in the world, this is the best in the world, Love is the best in the world, like, look at all the parity we have, like, we go five sets all the time, this player said the French league's no good, like, and constantly feeding bio information that in a lot of cases wasn't necessarily relevant anymore. It got incredibly frustrating, and it really, and I would say that this is true for the announcers that we heard almost across the board.
Yeah.
I don't know if they were told what messaging to push, but it was pretty consistent.
Yeah.
And when I'm watching volleyball, and maybe this is a personal preference, I don't know if our listeners enjoyed what they were delivering from a presentation perspective. But as a volleyball watcher, I like to hear about the strategy. What did the players see in this situation? Why did they make that choice? And I don't know if the announcers were just not experienced enough in the actual game to be able to deliver that type of information. But it was just a consistent delivery of why is this league so good? Look at all the amazing players we have, and here's their bio. And a lot of the times, things that the announcers would say were just blatantly untrue.
But it was also on repeat. Like, if you're watching a five-set match with Jordan Larson, it is cool to bring up some of the things that she's done. 100%.
But if I have to hear one more time that Sammy Francis was 5 years old when Jordan Larson started her pro career, like, one time is enough.
Yeah, there wasn't a variety of information. The same things came up over and over and over again.
And that's why I feel like you need to have an understanding of high-level volleyball and be educated. Like, my thing is, if you're going to talk about the other leagues in the world, have a real understanding of them. Don't just make statements about these leagues when it is very clear that you have no idea what you're talking about. Just don't bring them up at all if that's the case. talk about the volleyball if biographical information is relevant to forward what you're trying to say in educating the viewers about high-level volleyball, by all means, add it. But to constantly say the same things...
It almost seemed like they couldn't get behind their own product of in terms of the level at which it was being executed. They wanted to talk about either other things or just love in and of itself besides the match that we were watching.
We could go on about this forever. We'll stop it there.
I'm actually very curious to know. I mean, you and I are obviously very entrenched in volleyball. We've spent a lot of our lives doing it. We're very deep within it. I'm curious what the average viewer thought about the presentation.
But that's the thing, is they are feeding them misinformation. That's the thing that bothers me, is you want to say all these things about your league, but in the process, you are misinforming the viewer about what is out there and what the other leagues are actually like. Like, that is something that I take issue with. It's like, you are, as an announcer, your job is to educate the viewer, and to feed them false information is just doing a disservice to everybody. So, I don't know. I'm clearly very passionate about this. But, and as I said, we could talk about this forever. But, putting that aside, I would say, if I was just looking at the volleyball, I think it was a successful first year. I like what they stand for. I, for the most part, enjoyed watching the games. Yeah, I'm curious to see if they're going to make any adjustments next year. But, like, just taking it for what it is and watching the volleyball, I thought it was good.
Yeah, you always have to start somewhere. And I thought the product they put on the floor, you could tell they put a lot of effort into it. You could tell the players were excited to be in the U.S., which I think was important to a lot of people and was a benchmark for this happening. And again, to me, it's about how you evolve and how you move forward. So I'm very curious to see what they keep for next year and how it goes. I hope they continue to evolve.
All right. We have been sitting on a few extra love questions in our inbox. So now that love is wrapped up, all of our listener questions have to do with love. So we can really put a bow on this season and wait for the next one. So our first question is Maddie Kubik Banks or Jaylee Winters?
I think she answered the question this weekend.
Maddie Kubik Banks.
Next.
No, we got this question very early in the season, and at that point Maddie Kubik hadn't been playing much. So we kind of held on to it. As Maddie got some matches under her belt and we were able to really compare, I don't think it's even close.
I would agree.
Question number two. Do you think Love and the PVF would ever play one another as preseason matches or do their own version of a Champions League?
Not in the next 5 years. I think that everybody has their own vision of what volleyball should be. I think everybody's very focused internally on putting together their best product. And I don't think we've come to a point where cooperation is in the cards. I think it's still too much of a competition. And I think that both sides would look at it as a lose-lose, right? If you're Love and you lose to a PVF team, you're fostering the narrative that you're the best league here and then your team loses. And the same for PVF is like you're trying to build that and then you go and you lose, then you have like a definitive marker of what league is better than the other league. I don't think at this point cooperation is in the air. So this is a bit of a long one, but will Love be able to maintain their current status as the top American league in the future? Love started recruiting players at least 1 year earlier, so most were locked in before the PVF started. Salary scales are about the same. Both leagues are well short of the top European leagues. It seems to me that with one league owner, Love will struggle to keep the top talent home in the long run unless they add additional investors. It also seems like the schedule wouldn't work well for a significant TV contract. What are your thoughts?
Well, if MLV has anything to say about it, they won't be taught for long. I'm just kidding. Okay. I think we've kind of touched on their schedule and how just to maintain interest, it kind of should change. But I think in going to that one match head-to-head format would definitely be more conducive to solid TV contracts. I mean, Love is still recruiting early. They have, you know, sophomores and juniors in big programs that have committed to the league. So they are well in advance of PVF on that front. With the new news that PVF is increasing some of their salaries, I don't know what that comparison is going to look like in the future. But I think given Love's recruiting strategy, I think that they will be able to maintain that status for a little while. Do I think they'll be able to keep the young in their prime talent at home for long? No. Not with the strength of the other leagues that are out there in the world. And, I mean, it depends on players' national team aspirations, their own professional aspirations. But I think, despite that, they will maintain their status.
I have two thoughts on this. One, if they got a legitimate TV contract, they would be open to modifying their schedule. So I don't think that that is necessarily an issue. I think that the current schedule falls in line with their mission and with the ability to kind of travel everybody to one location. I think it probably ends up saving them money, but with an investment for TV, I don't think they'd have an issue changing it. Two, I'm curious to see when these top founding athletes stop playing, what the recruiting looks like. Because right now, to stand on a court with your founding athletes, with Jordan Larson, with Jordan Thompson, with some of the setters and the liberos, that's a draw. Like, those are icons for some of those kids playing and coming through college right now. When they retire, I'm curious to see if the league has the same draw. So that's something that I've thought about.
Fair point. Our final question is another long one, but I find it very interesting. And it is kind of in reference to Rachel Fairbanks. So how would you feel about never crossing the finish line? The finish line is referring to a specific hurdle. Maybe it's a quarterfinal, a semi, always coming second. How would you feel about never overcoming that particular hurdle? When we see Rachel Fairbanks, her team, Atlanta's semifinal loss in Love, makes her 0-5 in semifinal matches because she was 0-4 in the final four with Pitt and now this. Is this something that would affect you down the road? Is this something that you would think about when you reach future semifinal matches? And at what point do you think those hurdles and losses affect your belief to go beyond that threshold? This question is so good.
Well, I think it definitely affects you. You can't help but think about it. And quite frankly, anybody who does media for sports loves bringing this stuff up. So you can't get away from it. It's definitely a thing. Even when coaching, you have teams that, you know, you can't get across the line. And I think you have to acknowledge it. You have to have a plan with dealing with it, and whether that's with your teammates or whether that's maybe with a coach or a sports psych. If you pretend it doesn't exist or it's not there, it will come back and it will haunt you. You need to understand it. You need to understand why, and then you need to prepare to overcome it. And I don't think there's any other way to do it.
I definitely think it's in Rachel Fairbanks' mind, for sure. And now, having this streak extended into her pro career, she 100% will be thinking about it every time she makes a semifinal. I think the beauty of volleyball is that it's such a big sport that you're constantly changing teammates. So while it may be in the back of your mind, it's not necessarily a team identity. I understand for Pitt and in her situation at Pitt, yes, it is. I think as she enters the pro environment, it's not so much a team identity thing. I think it's just, it is there and it's something that she's going to have to overcome. And I find it interesting because every time that she got subbed in for that double sub, her first set was unhittable.
Not good.
So that is something that she is going to have to address with a sports psych for sure. Have you ever been in a situation like that?
When I played in university, we made the final like 2 years in a row in our conference championships, and we lost both times in the final match. And as a team, so we had all graduated after our fourth year, but in Canada, you can play a fifth year. All of us except two guys decided to come back because we just weren't happy with how that ended for us, and we wanted to win. And everybody was committed and worked hard and came back, and we were able to win the next year. But yeah, I've definitely been there.
I think for me, it was probably when I started playing beach. That hurdle was going from the quarterfinals to the semis. And I think for my first two seasons on the beach, like, we came fifth several times, but we could not make that flip to get into the semis. And then we finally did, and then we're able to medal several times. But I can't even tell you like what it was that kind of made that jump though.
Well, I think your partner had a little more baggage than you in that regard, because she had been playing beach for longer than you and hadn't necessarily kind of gotten to that point. But it was preparation. It was looking for the team you were playing. It was getting that break where you had a few plays go your way. And it was, to me, it was about belief and being able to do it.
I don't think it didn't affect me mentally. Like, I knew it was happening, and I would tell myself, like, we need, once we get past this match, we're going to medal for sure. It's just getting past this match. But in the moment, I don't recall it being necessarily like a mental block. It was always just like it was a belief that I was like, once we can just overcome this like hurdle, we will get there. It definitely messes with you. I really like that question.
Great question. So now that love is over and there's no more love to watch, here's what we think you should be watching this week. So the men's Italian league semifinals Wednesday on Volleyball TV. Women's Italian league finals Wednesday on Volleyball TV.
And those are 3 out of 5, everybody, okay?
I would encourage you, if you're a fan of women's volleyball, to watch those women's Italian League final matches. They are a ton of fun. There's firepower everywhere. It is intense. You will not be disappointed. And Volleyball TV, you can kind of go back and watch it whenever you want. So even if the timing's not great, check it out. In NCAA men's action, USC and UCLA have their series this week. That's going to be a ton of fun. Should be a great game. I want to see USC's response to getting swept by Stanford. Those are Thursday at 10 p.m. Eastern and Saturday at 8 p.m. Eastern on the Big Ten Plus. Pepperdine plays BYU Friday and Saturday. Both of those are at 9 p.m. Eastern on Big Ten Plus.
So these are very important matches.
Very
because
important.
These are the top four teams in the MPSF. And with USC falling, dropping two matches, they split with Pepperdine, with BYU. Like, this weekend it's all going to shake out as to what the standings are. And USC is trying to desperately not finish fourth, because that means they match up with UCLA in the semi.
Yep. So that will be must-see TV for volleyball fans. For the PVF, San Diego plays Columbus on Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern, and Atlanta plays Omaha on Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern, and that one's on Roku. For those of you who are not familiar with Roku, I was actually able to download the free version of Roku and find the matches, so it's not necessarily a paid service, although they do have those options. But for anybody who's wondering, you can still access those matches for free.
That concludes this week's episode of Volley Talk. There's always something shaking in the volleyball world, and we hope you enjoyed this little fix. Be sure to follow the show so you don't miss any updates, and we'd be so grateful if you'd leave us a 5-star review. You can also find us on Instagram at volleytalk_podcast. If you have a topic that you want us to discuss, be sure to let us know by reaching out to us on Instagram or at info@sarahpavin.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll be back in 2 weeks, not next week, in 2 weeks, because we are traveling, so there will not be an episode next week. So we'll see you in 2 weeks. Bye.